Case number 21-7040, Mark Schaffer, individually and on behalf of all others similarly situated at all, appellants, versus George Washington University and Board of Trustees of George Washington University, 20 CV 1417, and case number 21-7064, Mas Qureshi, individually and on behalf of all others similarly situated at all, appellants, versus American University. Mr. Kurowski for the appellant Mark Schaffer, Mr. Willie for the appellant Mas Qureshi, Mr. Schoenfeld for the appellee George Washington University, Mr. Schoenfeld for the appellee American University.
Good morning, Mr. Kurowski. Or afternoon, is it afternoon? No, it's still morning.
We're still good, Your Honor. good morning. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Kurowski, and I represent the appellants in the Schaffer versus George Washington University. And our clients were plaintiffs in the matter before the district court. And our clients paid George Washington University not simply to obtain a diploma and receive credits, but they paid amounts of money that were very large in order to have the opportunity to go to college. And so in accordance with the written materials that George Washington itself drafted, throughout the history of our clients' interactions with George Washington, and through the first half of the spring 2020 semester, Your Honors, they received just that. But during the second half of the spring 2020 semester, George Washington provided something that nobody bargained for. Students attended school away from campus, barred from facilities, resources, and facilities that accompany an on-campus education and for which they had always received throughout the history of their interactions with George Washington. So when George Washington converted to remote learning in the spring of 2020 in response to the coronavirus pandemic, it provided some refunds for some things like room and board, but it refused to provide pro rata refunds for things like tuition, certain mandatory fees. And as a result of that, we filed suit on behalf of our clients. Now, unfortunately, from our perspective, the case was dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage. But consistent with the requirements set out in Rule 8 and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and when applying basic contract law and including contract law as it applies in the educational context within the law of the District of Columbia, we alleged each and every element necessary to plead an unjust enrichment.
I think if there's a, I say this with hesitation, given that there's some snow predicted in our weather, but if there were a big snowstorm, that shut down sort of everything and power is out for say a week of classes. And so they aren't able to provide on-campus education, or classes or activities for that week, till the power is restored and the ice is scraped off the road. Would that be a breach of contract, or is it the length of time that's at issue here?
I'd say at the start, one, that sort of short temporary scenario is not our case. And this is a situation
where I know that's not your case. Yeah. I'm asking the legal contract, your theory of the contract here.
Sure.
And so take my hypothetical, and everything's shut down for, you know, some Monday to Friday due to lack of electricity, ice covered roads, streets, no classes, no activities can be provided. Is that a breach of contract, or does the contract allow for short interruptions?
Sure. I think in going back to the situation, that's a type of situation I think we would not say it's a breach of contract in this mm-hmm. instance because of the short duration of it. And I think part of the reason for that is when courts within DC are looking at contracts and interpreting contracts, one of the things that they're looking for is is, you know, you're looking at the conduct of the parties and the situation and the milieu in which they've dealt is the kind of the way that one court has put it. And so when you're looking at the way that the parties have dealt with each other in the past and the way that they, and sort of what their reasonable expectations are, I think.
Okay. So the contract that you're envisioning is to provide, I'm just going to call it as a shorthand, on-campus education. That's the classes, the activities, opportunities to go to sort of buildings and specialized services and things. On-campus education includes within it a recognition that there can be extreme circumstances can interrupt it at least for a short period of time.
To a certain extent, I think the way that we've put it, and I think I better phrase it, Your Honor, is that, you know, although we, you know, understand that certain things happen and classes could be canceled or campus events might be rescheduled, you know, one thing would remain constant, and that is that, you know, the bargain was for an on-campus education and the core benefits that accompany it. And if there's sort of a temporary interruption in that, you know, I can't say we'd be before this court and bring a case on it. But
I'm not asking whether you'd be bringing a lawsuit. I'm asking what your vision of the contractual obligation is.
And it's, you know,
it allows for those short interruptions.
We wouldn't object to that, those short
interruptions. I'm not asking an objection. I'm asking your vision of the contract terms. Sure. Do you agree that, because we're dealing with, you know, we don't have a nice four corners contract here. So the different sources you're drawing from, you would agree that those do not obligate them to provide the full panoply of on-campus education in extreme circumstances for short periods of time. The problem is here, it was, you know, I guess functionally half a semester.
I think in some, yes, Your Honor, I'd agree.
And then if, do you dispute, I mean, because I read your complaint, tell me if I'm wrong, that there's not really a dispute here that neither GW or AU just said, huh, professors would all like to go on vacation. We're just going to switch to online education, that it was all caused by the COVID pandemic. Is that, are we agreed on? That's not a fact that's in dispute, that the transition to online or remote learning was caused by the pandemic.
We have alleged in our complaint that the transition occurred because of the pandemic.
And do you don't dispute that in fact, at least as of March 24th, it would have been illegal for GW or the American University to operate on campus, provide on-campus lessons or activities because all non-essential businesses had been shut down by order of the mayor?
I don't think that was as deep clearly pled in the case, so I can't.
I don't know what part wasn't pled. You said COVID caused the shutdown.
Yeah,
in terms of judicial notice of Mayor Bowser's lockdown order.
Sure, and I think my point was toward this way, that whether it was illegal or not. And I don't think that we, you know, flush that out before the district court.
You don't need to. Do you at least concede that it was infeasible, that they could not, under the circumstances, actually provide in-person instruction during this time?
I think that, you know, we would agree that, but I think that has important consequences, Your Honor. And what that involves is issues of impossibility. And when
well, not necessarily, and I don't want to jump into, maybe Judge Millett is going there. So not necessarily. I think that may actually have an implication for the kind of promise that you need to have had the university to make in order to state a claim for breach in this case, right? I mean, it seems to me that if you concede that it was infeasible for the university to actually provide in-person instruction, then in order to state a claim for breach, you needed the university to promise to provide in-person instruction no matter what, right? It had to be an unconditional guarantee of in-person instruction, because if their promise was, we will provide in-person instruction as long as it's feasible, or we will do our best to provide in-person instruction or, you know, some conditional promise like that, then you lose because we know it wasn't feasible. We know they did their best. So the only thing that gets you to actual breach in this case is if the university said, we guarantee you, not necessarily explicitly, they could have said it implicitly, but it had to be a guarantee of in-person instruction. And so I'd like to know whether you actually allege that they essentially made a money back guarantee in this way. And if you do allege that, is it plausible that a university would make that kind of guarantee to their students, especially when they have reserved the right to change programs, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure, Your Honor. And breaking that apart, I think there's some parts that I would agree with you on and some parts I think I disagree with you on.
Okay.
I think starting, you know, from the first instance, you know, did George Washington have to say, we agree no matter what or no matter the circumstances to provide in-person education? GW didn't say that one way or the other.
No, wait, let me just be clear. I'm not saying that they had to make an express statement. I'm not saying that they had to actually say it. I agree that they can promise implicitly. But the question is, what was the promise? What did they actually promise to do? So they could have implicitly, I suppose, promised money back guarantee kind of certainty that you would be able to go to class, right? Fine. But where is that in terms of the allegations or the facts in this case?
Gotcha. I think that there's a number of principles under DC law that we use in order to assert a plausible claim for breach of contract in this case. And so when courts are construing contracts involving universities and students, you know, it's not a clean document. There's no, of course, document titled contract. So we're looking at things like communications, but not just communications, Your Honor. We're also looking at the usual practices and reasonable expectations. And so there's a whole line of case law in DC that recognizes that contracts are to be read by reference to the norms of conduct and the expectations founded upon them.
But don't we have the Bash case that says expectations are not enough to establish a binding promise? I thought we had that line of authority too.
Well, I think the Bash case is helpful in a general regard, but you know, I think it's certainly not helpful to an addition for one important reason, and that is Bash was a summary judgment decision. And so there's an opportunity for fact finding that occurs as a part of that, and discovery happened.
Right,
and,
but can you narrow in very kind of focused on what it is that you're alleging the university promised to your students? And am I right or wrong that as a matter of law, under these particular circumstances, that promise had to be unconditional in terms of the university saying, essentially, not saying, but acting as if, you have to be able to have the in-person experience no matter what?
The promise did not have to be unconditional.
Why not?
George Washington, could have drafted a disclaimer or a reservation of right that was so clear and unambiguous that it could provide itself an out. And I think the problem gets
an out from what, though, right? You're asking us to infer an implied promise. So I'm just trying to figure out whether whether it makes any sense to infer that they intended to make the kind of promise that would bind them to providing in-person instruction no matter what. And I think you have to have that, because if they were to, you know, I could agree with you that there was some promise here and that promise might even encompass in-person instruction, that they promised that you would have an in-person experience. The question is, was that promise a conditional one, right? That you would have an in-person experience so long as we're able to provide it, as long as it's feasible for us to do so. why isn't that the sort of outer bounds of the plausible promise that the university makes to its students about in person?
Because the university never made such a statement limiting when it would or would not provide in-person education. And so that's why we're falling back on
default. Maybe they couldn't just say, oh, we don't think it's feasible. We just had to pay some huge amount of our endowment to settle some litigation or something. So that's, it's not just that it's not feasible, but is it not an inherent component of every contract that compliance in violation of law is not required? Courts can't enforce a contract if its terms, if its operation, even if initially it was a valid contract, something happened, and now it would be unlawful for one party to comply. Does that have to be written, or is that just not inherent? As courts, there's plenty of case law that courts will not enforce contractual obligations that themselves are contrary to law. That's got to be part of this contract, doesn't it?
I think as a matter of general fundamental principles, you're right, Your Honor.
And I don't want to ask about general fundamental principles. I want to ask, isn't that inherently a part of whatever contract you had here, that compliance that requires illegal conduct? For example, if DW had said, we're going to keep having classes, and if you do not show up, or if you show up wearing a mask, we'll kick you out. If you don't show up, we're going to mark you absent, and five absences lead to a failing grade. So if the school kept going and forced students to come or fail, surely students could say, you can't enforce that. That's a breach of contract. But you can't force us to engage in unlawful conduct in violation of the district order and in peril of our own health. Wouldn't they? Could the students bring such a claim in such a situation?
I don't know if in that situation they could, Your Honor, because the way and I'm trying to break it apart a little bit here.
Okay.
That might be where the disconnect is. When we're looking at contracts in the educational context and, you know, an implied contract situation, you're looking at historically how have the people dealt with each other. And the way that you presented it, Your Honor, involves like novel fact issues that aren't here. But I'd like to, you know, say backing up.
I'm just presenting from the flip side my exact point about, can one party compel, circumstances have changed. I'm not talking about a contract that's illegal ab initio, right? Circumstances change. And so if it's unlawful for the student to do their part, or if it's unlawful for the university to do its part,
I think in that instance,
that's in every contract, isn't it?
I would say yes, to a certain extent, Your Honor, it implied, if anything, under the law. But I think what the important thing and distinction to keep in mind here is that what in such a situation, that doesn't mean people are left without any remedies. And so,
but there's no breach. Judge Millett's point is that there's no breach in that case. If that's in every contract, then setting it up the way that I would think about it, that's a condition. That the party is saying, I will offer you in-person classes so long it is not unlawful to do so. So that if that's the contract in this situation, it would have been unlawful, so there's no breach, right?
Well, we disagree that there is no breach. I think the way that Your Honors have been phrasing it involves a lot of different fact issues and questions above and beyond the question of whether we have pled a breach. And the way that
I'm not sure this isn't anything that's not apparent from the face of your complaint and, you know, judicial notice of the mayor's lockdown order. But I think the point is that when a contract that's perfectly lawful contract becomes, due to circumstances beyond anyone's control, legally unenforceable by a court, right? A court could assume a court couldn't say you breached the contract by not taking these illegal actions.
And I'd like to.
That's just a launch pad into unjust enrichment, isn't it?
Correct. If a contract remedy would
that's
not
a different
be
question. If we can't, enforcement of the contract is no longer something a court can do. That doesn't mean that you may win or lose, but it doesn't mean that you wouldn't get the opportunity to say there was never an agreement that the students would bear the the full cost of such, that, you know, only one party would bear the full cost of such a development. I mean, that's a whole other issue. I'm sorry.
Ask a couple of questions. I saw your complaint. The background for me, and you can tell me if I'm misreading it, the background for me, the DC law is pretty clear over a long period of time that the relationship between the university and a student is contractual in nature. So we know that there is a contractual commitment coming from the university. And I thought what your claim was that the university, reading all of the relevant materials, and especially using the implied in fact test, what you're saying is that the university promised that as a general practice, we offer live education on campus as a general practice. And that is our promise to you. And so there are any of number of examples that I could give. There was one in the district court in Delaware. I asked counsel, for example, could the university announce, oh, you know, we're running out of money. You have to learn on your own now. Is that permissible? And no one on either side was confused that that breached the implied promise made by the university, which was, as a general practice, we're having live education and campus arrangement. I understood some of the claims that my colleagues are raising to be matters that could be raised in a motion to dismiss case as defenses raised by the universities. That is, it was impossible, it was unlawful, whatever, and we could not have lived up to that implied contract. And you might lose on that pretty readily. And I think it's easy to see the pandemic being raised as a defense to your implied contract claim. And then the last piece, again, I just want to make sure I'm understanding your thinking. The last piece of what I understood was that you were saying, in any event, it doesn't matter because we surely have an unjust enrichment claim and the possibility of restitution here. If the universities, both of these universities, distinguish between live versus online, and they charge differently. They've already valued them differently. They charge substantially more for the regular live education and campus arrangements. And in one of them, they say, but you can be admitted and go online and get a degree, but you're not going to get what those who are paying the bigger money for. So what you were saying is, in your view, you think there is restitution that's due. But once again, we certainly can't decide that on a motion to dismiss. And as I understand your argument, they may win fairly quickly on your implied contract claim. And as I read your claim, there is a promise that our general practice is live, and you still may lose it because the pandemic knocks it out. But that is a matter that should not be decided on a motion to dismiss, because there are terms on the implied terms to be filled out, and we haven't filled them out yet. Am I understanding you correctly?
I think on a whole, Your Honor, I think that's a fair, accurate, and summary. And the only sort of quibble I'd say is, in terms of the issues of illegality or whether the pandemic prevented the contract from being executed, I think there's two points on that. One, that involves fact questions, not appropriate for resolution on a motion.
That's what I just said.
Okay, then we're on the same
page. Hang on, there's DC.
I'm sorry.
Let me just finish. All I said was, and I don't know what the answer to it is, all I said was that my understanding of your claim is it's a motion to dismiss. And at least in the cases in which I've read, that seems the correct answer. That is, you don't decide this on a motion to dismiss. There may be defenses that the university can raise, and they may be able to win them quickly. But in any event, you can't do it on a motion to dismiss. And the last piece of my understanding your argument is, you can plead alternatively under federal rules. And there's an argument in here in these two cases. One of the district judges has suggested you can't plead in the alternative. And I think you're saying, and I don't understand how you can't, you certainly can plead in the alternative, the express contract, the implied contract, and the unjust enrichment. I got your position correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
I just wanted to follow up.
Go ahead. Yes.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge Millett.
The D.C. Circuit law that says, explicitly holds that an affirmative defense may be raised by pre-answer motion under Rule 12, that is our 12b6 stage, when the facts that give rise to the defense are clear from the face of the complaint. And it's clear from the face of the complaint, and you've agreed here that the reason, the one and only reason that these two universities halted the provision of on-campus education, to which you claim contractual entitlement, was a pandemic, a public health emergency, which in very short order became subject to a lockdown order enforceable by civil and criminal penalties in the District of Columbia, none of which is disputed, all of which is on the face of your complaint, or we can take judicial notice of the lockdown order that ensued from the pandemic causation that you have acknowledged. And so we don't really have to wait for a later summary judgment in this very unusual circumstance. I mean, that's what struck me. There's no one disputes what happened, why this happened, and no one seems to dispute that had there not been a pandemic, y'all would have stayed on campus for the rest of the semester. And I don't hear any dispute, but please tell me if this is one of the facts you think you need to look into, that it would have been contrary to the directions of public health officials locally, nationally, and internationally to continue holding classes. And it would have been, once the lockdown order issued, in violation of district law to have held classes. So this is an unusual type of contract claim. And it's pretty settled as well on this motion to dismiss that a court, even if it's a perfectly valid contract, a court can't enforce terms that become contrary to law. So I don't understand why. Please explain to me more what facts you think need to get developed on this narrow question of whether a court could hold that the obligation to provide on-campus education continued at a minimum after the lockdown order was issued. What facts need to be developed that would have allowed GW or AU to continue providing on-campus education after the lockdown order?
Sure. I think one, the facts would include whether and to what extent and the breadth of which the applicable orders that were used.
That's not a fact. That's reading the law. I mean, we can pull it up. That's pulled it up. You can pull it up.
What are you saying? Whether the classes were mass gatherings that were prohibited? I mean, is that the way you're cutting it? Because the law, you may be right. The law didn't say, I don't know this. The law didn't say universities can't have classes, as I recall. I thought the law said focus more on mass gathering. Is that what you're talking? I'm asking, is that what you're talking about?
It is, Your Honor. So for example, could...
That's not the lockdown order. The lockdown order allowed public and private universities to remain open solely for the purpose of facilitating distance learning and distance operations, modifying facilities to address the public health issues. And then, you know, there was transition time on university housing. That's not on-campus education. On-campus education was forbidden by the lockdown order.
And the reason why I think that's a...
That's not a fact question. That's a law question.
Sure, Your Honor. And I think where I'm struggling with responding to Your Honor in the way that you phrased it is because, you know, I'm stepping back to the concept where, you know, principles and contracts are to be read in light of the conditions and circumstances existing at the time that they were entered into. And yes, the pandemic, yes, and everything is a subsequent situation. And so when you have something that comes up later...
No, counsel, no, Judge Millett and Judge Jackson are right that if the law, and I just don't remember the details now, we're all so sick of this that we can remember anything. If the law really effectively said classes cannot happen, they have to be closed down, and you use remote learning. I mean, however, I'm doing it in a very loose way, but if that's what the law said, and everyone knows that, we're not going to take that past the motion to dismiss if you're in that situation and we all know, and you're not claiming the law is impermissible. Why would we take that past the restitution and unjust dismissal?
Enrichment.
In any event, that's a different issue. I don't know how that can possibly survive.
Mr. Schaefer, can I just sort of summarize this in a different, Mr. Kurowski. Can I summarize this in a little different way, what I hear is going on here? And it's sort of what I alluded to begin with. I actually don't see this as accelerating the impossibility defense, because a defense only occurs and is only necessary if we believe that there was a breach, right? If the defendant were to say, yes, we breached the contract, we had promised X, we did not give X, that is a breach of contract, but here's our defense, impossibility, right? What I thought this case was about was whether and to what extent the university made a promise to continue education in person under all circumstances. And the reason why you had to have that, in my view, is because you have conceded that it was infeasible, unlawful, or whatever, for the university to continue. So the only way you have a breach, the only way you're able to say they did something that we now are entitled to get a remedy for, right? They broke their promise, is if they had promised you that they would go forward regardless, right? Initially, when the promise was made, we are giving you a money back guarantee that you will get in-person instruction under all circumstances. And so then you come and say, yeah, we know that you couldn't give it, but you promised us that under all circumstances, we'd be entitled to it. So you've breached. And my worry is that in this situation that we have right here, we don't have any written language from the university. You're correct about that. So we're all trying to figure out what the university implicitly promised. And where I get hung up is trying to find an implicit promise of the university that they would go forward under all circumstances. I don't see that in the materials. I don't see the circumstances as even plausibly giving rise to that, especially when they had language in their various materials that gave them the right to make changes. The other thing that I think I would like for you to speak to, perhaps, and I know your other counsel should have an opportunity, so maybe you want to pitch this to him, is this notion of in-person versus online learning and the difference in the value. I don't really know whether that hurts you or helps you. And let me tell you why I think that's the case, because we're also trying to figure out what is the core of the product that is being offered by a university. And one could conceive of that core as instruction classes toward credits that you can put to get a degree at the university, or instruction for credit toward a degree. That happens whether it's online or in person. That seems to me like the core. And the fact that the university could offer different products, one that's in person versus one that's online, to me indicates that the in-person nature of it is actually not the core of it, that's kind of ancillary. You pay more for that if you want it in that format, but the real thing is just getting classes for credit that you can put toward a degree, and that you've gotten that, whether you did it, you know, during a pandemic time, online or not, and therefore the university has not actually breached the core of what it is that it promised to its students. So I don't know if you want to react to that, or you want to, if you know, you want to wait and let Mr. Wiley do it.
Sure, I'll offer my thoughts, Your Honor, and then, you know, certainly if you want to ask questions of Mr. Willie, I, you know, I don't know how you want to split up our time across the people. And I understand, you know, we're certainly past the time. You know, I'd say that, you know, one, in terms of the points Your Honor made about the core of the deal, the core of the deal that you would describe sounds to me to be different than the core of the deal that we've described. And right. The core of the deal that we've described is and emphasized is the importance of the in-person education. And so when we're stepping back to apply.
Because there is a difference in understanding, I want to make sure it's clear in my head what your position is, not who's right. My understanding was you were saying nothing more than, and indeed the materials you point to don't say anything more than this applied deal that as a general practice will give live on-campus education, nothing more, nothing about no matter what. There was no, you're not claiming there was a no matter what promise. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I'll add that, you know, that no matter what issue, I disagree with. That's a point George Washington has made in their brief that, you know, there's no promise of no matter what. That matters because George Washington, you know, we're looking at the bulletin. It could have drafted the terms differently. It could have expressly reserved the school.
No, I'm just asking. I want to just confirm because there is a difference here. I just want to confirm my understanding. Your complaint is not that they breached a contract because we think they made a promise of on campus live, no matter what. My understanding was you were saying nothing more than their promise is that as a general practice, it would be live and on campus. Is that right?
That's right. They promised in-person instruction, Your Honor.
As a general practice.
As a general practice and as it applies here.
No, so why was there a breach? If the promise was we will give you in-person instruction as a general practice, not as a no matter what, as a general practice, why under these circumstances where you concede that they couldn't do it under these circumstances, it was infeasible, it was unlawful, why is there a breach? Why is that a breach of the promise to not give it under these circumstances? Because this was not a general, ordinary situation. This was the unusual situation.
Yeah,
so they didn't break their promise, right?
Well, I think in this instance, it would kind of have to be tie in with the fact that there was no refund provided. So for example, in addition to closing the campus, for example, one of the things that are not at issue is room and board. So students were sent home and those students that received room and board that went off campus received refunds for their.
But those are based on different promises, right? There are other promises that relate to room and board. You pay this extra money and you get to stay in the dorm, right? You pay this extra money and you get a certain number of meals. Those are other promises that required, because those are the core of those promises, a refund because they paid the extra money and they couldn't stay in the dorm. So fine. With respect to tuition, right? If Judge Edwards is correct, and if your complaint is read to be the promise that you'll have in-person education classes as a general matter, not no matter what, but as a general matter, why is there a breach in this case?
Because George Washington kept the entirety of the money, even though it delivered a different product.
Okay, so I think what you're saying is there were two promises here. The default rule is, first one is on-campus education as a default rule, and we don't have to decide on what terms they could change it because in this case, it was driven by external circumstances. The law wouldn't have allowed them to do it. So that whatever might or might not fall in the general rule or presumption of when they could change that provision of on-campus education, this one has to be right that they could stop it. But you're saying there's a second promise that you're implying, right or wrong, but your complaint is alleging is that if all the students are getting is online classes, then all they should be paying is your online tuition. And so that there was a promise that if you turned us into online students and no longer on-campus students, at least for a significant period of time, we'll give you a snow day or two, then at that point, you wouldn't treat us financially like still on campus students. So there's two promises. Am I saying it right?
I think breaking it apart, Your Honor, that sounds right. And I think both of them kind of come down to the notion that, you know, our clients didn't receive the benefit of their bargain.
But I have to say, Mr. Kraske, they reduced to the same thing. I don't see two promises. The second promise is just a money back guarantee that you're going to be on campus, right? I mean, you can't hold both of those in the same set of circumstances. What Judge Millett has said effectively, I think, with respect to the second promise is, unless you're on campus, you get your money back. That's the promise. And I just want to know, is that what you are alleging that they said? And is it plausible that the university would have made that promise to its students, knowing that ice storms happen, knowing that programs have to change? Is it plausible to believe that the university would have given the students a money back guarantee concerning on-campus experience? I think that is really what you have to establish.
And Your Honor, that's where I disagree. I think those are things that GW could have written down and concluded that they said, you know, no money back if we have to cancel or go to classes online. They could have said that, but they didn't. And so when we're done with what we're left with is application of general contract principles and
nothing in the lockdown order forbid it them. There's nothing unlawful about, if you're right, about them reimbursing some tuition, right? That doesn't stop them from that aspect.
Correct. And the lockdown order certainly doesn't eliminate our, opportunities to seek a remedy or limit students' remedies, whether expressly or impliedly.
That's your unjust enrichment argument. If the law descended and said this contract can't be enforced anymore, then you would go to unjust enrichment and argue about whether there was this agreement to partial money back or partial money back guarantee. That's a whole other argument, but that would be done under the guise of unjust enrichment because courts can't say there was a legal obligation to keep providing on-campus education in these circumstances.
That is where unjust enrichment would come in to fill the void. And certainly in our case, we weren't able to not fill in the void, would come in to provide a remedy. I think that's generally correct, Your Honor. Unless you have any additional questions specific to me,
my colleagues have any more questions for Mr. Kraske?
Give Mr. Willie a time to address the issues as well.
Is it Mr. Willie or Wiley? I'll let him answer. You don't have to answer that.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's Roy Willie, and I represent the Qureshi plaintiffs against American University. I also represent the Montesano plaintiffs in the case against Catholic University, which survived the motion to dismiss in this circuit. And what I would say is this. Let me start with Judge Jackson's question about breach, because I do think that cuts to the heart of the matter. And I think it's important to note that in American contract jurisprudence, we do not disclaim in the affirmative. That is to say that a contract does not need to say that I will perform it on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. In other words, if it's not disclaimed in the negative, if that contract does not say that it is not in effect on Sundays, then it is always in effect. And I am always expected to perform under that contract. And so
unless the law requires otherwise.
Right, Judge Millett, and that's where I'm going to next. So
before you go, is it your position, I take from what you've just said, that a party or a group, two parties cannot agree to a conditional contract? They cannot make promises that are conditional?
Two parties can agree to a conditional contract. And I think the important part of that here is the fact that one of those parties, American University, has been in existence and operated a campus during pandemics. American University operated a campus during the Spanish influenza pandemic, during the polio pandemic, during the H1N1 pandemic, and others, and had the ability.
So given that, is it your argument then is that it is plausible for us to conclude that when American made this promise, it intended it to be unconditional, meaning it was saying, you come to campus, you come on in person under all circumstances. See, previously, even in prior pandemics, we were able to operate. So our promise to you is you guaranteed in person. That's how you read the circumstances here.
Yes, and at worst, it's a factual question as to what the course of dealing and reasonable expectations of the students were under the circumstance. And that's where we get into Judge Millett's question about the snow days. We know that in Washington, D.C. or in Boston, where I went to college, we have snow days regularly. Washington, D.C. deals with snow days quite differently. American University deals with snow days quite differently than Harvard deals with snow days, for example. And the course of dealing between the parties and the reasonable expectations between the parties are what come into play in that circumstance. But here we actually have historical precedent where American University had the ability and they could have contracted.
There are was there a lockdown order with the 1919 pandemic?
That is not in the record. But what I will tell you is this, that this is not an enforcement action. And so the lockdown order is almost immaterial as to the motion to dismiss stage, because we are not asking for specific performance of the contract. And if you read the papers,
But you're saying you don't want specific performance, but you want damages, because from March 24th on,
right,
you want damages. They breached the contract by not continuing to provide on-campus education.
Right, and precisely because
the loss, but a court could not issue an order that said, how could a court issue an order that says, under this contract, they were obligated to continue providing on-campus education, notwithstanding the lockdown order? Because I know this is not specific performance, the time has long since run. But a court would define a breach on your theory, we would have to say it breached the contract not to provide on-campus education after the lockdown order.
It did breach the contract. I don't think that there's any question about that. And the difference,
give me an example of a court that has held, has said in terms, it is a breach of contract not to undertake promised actions that the government has declared unlawful.
The distinction in, I think, what we are getting at in respect to this contract and other contracts, this contract was prepaid. So in other words, the students had already performed. This is not a contract where there is ongoing course of performance from both parties. The students had already performed in terms of paying the tuition and fees.
That sounds like an issue for unjust enrichment. I want to focus solely on breach of contract. Okay. And you said they had a contractual obligation, given what happened during the Spanish pandemic, your allegations about that here, that they had a contractual obligation to continue providing on-campus education. You just said yes to that question. Okay. How can you have, tell me what your best case is that you can have a contractual obligation to provide, to undertake conduct that is contrary to law? It might have been lawful beforehand, but now it is contrary to law. What's your best case for a court saying we can hold that they still had that contractual obligation?
Well, I think you have to look at the facts here in terms of what we're dealing with in an educational contract, which
I guess I'm asking you for a case law that says
there is no educational contract-based case that looks at the factual predicate of reasonable expectations.
You don't need an education case for me. If you can show me any case for any contract where a court has said it's undisputed that continued performance would be unlawful, nonetheless, you breached the contract by not doing so.
Right. And I don't know that there is a case. And in an express contract scenario, which of course is what most contract cases that come to the court are, there is no factual analysis necessary for that.
Right. They have actually made the promise at issue. This is my point, which is slightly different than Judge Millett's, which is she says a contractual obligation is the key and whether or not it could still be performed in this way, even though it was unlawful. I say, is there even a contractual obligation in this situation? Because notwithstanding the university's prior activity and whatnot, we have to determine what the university intended to promise its students, right? Implicitly.
No.
I'm wrong about that? Isn't the intent of the parties with respect to the promise what governs in a contract situation?
No, with respect to the reasonable expectation of the parties, it is what the university would have reasonably expected the students to give it. And that's on page 12 of our brief. That's the Giles v. Howard University case. And that is exactly the point. You've honed in on exactly the point, which is this. What expectation would the students have with respect to that contract if it were to be breached? And we can look in our case.
No, Mr. Wiley, I'm sorry. I'm getting confused. I understood that the university had to make a promise to the students and that you were trying to enforce that promise in the context of this breach of contract action. Am I right about that? All right.
Correct.
So the question is, when we don't have language, when we don't have an actual written contract that says, I promise to give you in-person instruction, and we're trying to infer, right, whether there was an implicit promise to that degree, my question is, what exactly is the university promising? And we have to think about the university's intent. What would a university, what did this university intend to promise with respect to this issue? Am I wrong about that?
I disagree slightly with that. And let me read you the case site, which is on page 12 of our initial brief. And it says this. It's a quote from the Giles v. Howard University case. The standard is that of reasonable expectation. What meaning the party making the manifestation, the university, should reasonably expect the other party to give it. Not what manifestation the university intended the other party to give it, but what manifestation the university...
I'm not talking about the students. I'm just talking about the promise that the university is making to the students.
I agree.
Trying to enforce. Okay. So setting aside whatever the students are, or what they give the university in terms of the money, I just want to know what your view is of how we're supposed to understand the promise that the university was making to its students concerning their experiences on campus.
As it is pled in our consolidated complaint, it is a promise to provide with respect to tuition, and I would note that the tuition and fees claims are separate, but with respect to tuition, an in-person, on-campus educational experience, period. The university has the ability to come back and challenge that, and if they do, then we get into the factual question of what should the university have reasonably expected the students to believe they were getting. And let me give you a factual example.
Before you leave, I'm very interested in this point. You say a promise to provide in-person experience, period. The period matters to me because what I'm trying to understand is whether really, even if we saw that in writing in a contract, the university meant promise to provide in-person experiences so long as the law allowed it, so long as it was infeasible, so long as, right? Now,
right.
Maybe they didn't. Maybe your argument is no, they meant in-person period, meaning under all circumstances,
right?
Is that what your argument is? Under all circumstances, you get this experience.
That is what we have pled. And let me tell you why that matters. You why that matters.
Okay.
Why that matters is because it is what the students expected to be provided for what they had already paid. And I'll give you a factual example. Okay. So in the American University case on paragraphs 55 and 56 of our complaint, we specifically plead, which is a fact in the case, that American University provided students a 10% discount on tuition and didn't charge some of the fees for the summer and fall of 2020, where the students were online. So now we have a factual question of when the university did that after, did the students reasonably expect that if the university would have gone online in that spring 2020 semester, that they would have received some of the money back. Because
all right, now let me ask you, why is it our task then to evaluate the plausibility of a promise in that way? In other words, is the student's expectation reasonable when the materials themselves say things like, we reserve the right to change the formatting of our programming, right? So fine, maybe the students expected that, but we understand from DC law that an expectation is not enough. And we have some indicia in this record in the materials that you point us to that the university reserved its right to make changes, So even if the students heard that promise and expected it to be, we get it under all circumstances, how plausible is that the university was actually making that promise?
Well, I think at the outset, we're not really looking at plausibility. We're weighing facts when we get to that point. And Judge Friedrich in the Montesano v. Catholic opinion laid it out this way. She said the reservation of rights clearly permit the universities to make some changes to course programming and educational services, yet certain assumptions of the broader implied contract between the universities and their students are so fundamental that the reservation of rights cannot reasonably be interpreted to waive them. That quote was also in Judge Bibas's decision, yes, who was sitting by the, as.
But neither Bibas nor Frederick are construing the plaintiff's claim to be the university promised on-campus education no matter what. You agreed with my colleague that that's what your claim is. That makes no sense to me. That's what your claim is? The university is promised on-campus live no matter what? That's the promise? That doesn't fit custom and practice.
Well, that's exactly right, Judge Edwards. And perhaps I was not as specific as I should have been in explaining it. That is what is pled in this case, but that is exactly the same reason that I would not bring a case, for example, for a snow day, because the custom and practice, it's a factual question of what is the custom and practice,
right?
But the factual question as to snow days would most definitively be resolved in favor of the university.
No, but my point is your starting point makes no sense to me. Your starting point is that the university impliedly promised that we will be on campus live no matter what?
Until there is factual development within
the materials and the two judges, at least Bibas certainly doesn't view it that way. I don't think Friedrich does either, but that doesn't make any sense. That makes it a little bit harder for us to think about. But I think the claim can be nothing more than the university is promised as a general practice pursuant to custom and practice. We will have online and I'm not sorry, not online. We will have live and on campus education. That's what we are promising. And for example, it's just like Bibas raised the hypothetical for his parties. He said, does anyone doubt if the university announced tomorrow, we're losing money, we're going to have no more on campus and no more live. Is that a breach of the contract? Everyone agreed it's a breach.
Right.
Because it's inconsistent with custom and practice. It's not inconsistent with an express promise.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that's where we depart from the factual analysis versus what is pled. What I am telling you is what is pled in our complaint is that this promise was made. When you start analyzing the facts,
the university
has promised in person on campus educational services and its appurtenant benefits to its students. The university may come in and say, well, that wasn't a reasonable expectation of the students because of X, Y, and Z. But that is a factual question.
Right, so you're excluding the no matter what now. You're not saying it's no matter what.
We don't disclaim in the affirmative. So if we make a promise in American jurisprudence, it and contractual law, it is no matter what, unless we have a disclaimer to say it's not. And let me just add this briefly, and then I know Judge Jackson might have a question. There are other universities. I have about 50 or 60 of these cases nationwide. There are other universities that have disclaimers in their handbooks that specifically deal with pandemics, right, that have force majeure language, which could have been included. Parties have a right to contract. And the university, of course, I mean, it's not an adhesion contract. Right.
Do you disagree with Mr. Kurowski that implicit, at least implicit, in every contract is a limitation on performance that would be illegal?
Yes, there is a limitation on performance that would be illegal. Well, on specific performance, you cannot contract to
specific performance. No, I did not add that. I'm just saying that courts cannot enforce a contractual term. It's built into every contract that is unlawful for that party to perform.
The contract says, be ridiculous. The contract says the university can cut off the head of a student if they do poorly in a course. You think that's your basis for your claim?
No, of course you can't.
That in your complaint, but there's a clear contract provision. Right. And no, the reason we're not gonna give you the time of day is because it's an impermissible, right?
I agree. And I agree with that. I agree with that as a contract principle, but here is the difference that I'm trying to draw, and perhaps I'm not being clear. The students had already agreed to pay X amount for one thing, and in fact had paid.
Right. So if I call into the grocer and I say, here's my credit card, and they immediately charge me for peaches, bananas, whatever, and they know that I normally pick up a week later, but they got my money. And now, for very good lawful reasons, there are no peaches and bananas. What?
I get the money back. You get your money back.
Right. Is that so? How are we analyzing that under your notion of breach of contract?
You had an implicit contract.
Even though I paid in advance, is that what? What do you say? I want to hear what you're saying. I know what
you, in that instance, you had an implied sales contract for peaches, right, and bananas,
Performed. It cannot be, and no one's doubting.
Correct. And as a result, it was breached. And so they owe you the money back under the contract. And at the very least,
that's
the very
point. It's the, when a contract that was perfectly lawful when entered into becomes, due to circumstances beyond either party's control, unlawful to continue performance, then you can have an unjust enrichment claim. That's
right. My bananas and peaches are now unlawful to sell after I paid.
There's been a recall because of their infested.
There's been a recall. They cannot be sold because they're dirty. They are now they weren't lawful when I paid, and I paid for them. Mm-hmm. And now I come in. How do I analyze it under
can you survive
a motion to dismiss?
Yes. Let me add one more element to that. So
take my hypothetical.
Okay.
Don't change my hypothetical.
There's a middleman involved. And
No. Bananas and peaches, they're unlawful now. You can't sell.
Let me ask you this, though. If they're unlawful, if that's right. Yeah. Right. They're unlawful, and so the grocer cannot get them, right?
No, the grocer has them sitting.
He has them.
Sorry, Judge Edwards, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. No, can't sell.
I have them sitting here on my shelf.
I cannot sell them.
Yeah, I can't though because the government has said.
I cannot sell these.
But the money comes back under contract damages. Here is how unjust enrichment in that circumance would come into play, and I'll.
You switched to unjust enrichment?
I'm not, because okay. Under that hypothetical, that is a contract damage. We have contracted for the purchase of those items. I have paid you. You cannot deliver them to me. You owe me my money back. The court cannot specifically enforce that contract and make you deliver the product, but
Can I just add to this hypothetical? Because I think it's very helpful. I hear what my colleagues are saying about it, but what if the hypothetical was the scenario in which the original agreement wasn't as clear as you give me the money and I'll give you bananas and peaches? What if instead the grocer is a local small grocer who only sometimes has these items come into stock, and the promise is you can give me the money, but I promise to give you the bananas and peaches if I get them from my distributor, right? If I get them. And it turns out, so, right? And right, what right. you are paying for in that original circumstance is essentially the incorporating the risk that the grocer might not get them.
Right. That is a different promise, and it's a factual question about which promise was made. And let me give you this hypothetical that I've used, which is exactly like that. And it's the fast food drive-through hypothetical. Okay. When I pull up to the fast food drive-through and I place my order, I am reasonably certain, but not as certain as I might be at some places, that whatever I order, when I go to window one and pay for it, I'm going to pick it up in window two, right? If for some reason, when I get to window two, my order is wrong, I'm entitled to my money back under that implied sales contract. Now imagine this with the illegality.
This
argument.
Is a different, this is the, this is the, this, that's why I think things are getting mixed up here, because I was asking the simple question.
Illegality.
The cannot lawfully comply. And you said that would still be a breach of contract. So I would love to see a case citation that says, even when performance would be unlawful, we will treat it as a breach of contract not to have done that.
And I'd really like to hear this too. I think we're talking about on a motion to dismiss and trying to decide credit your arguments or not. Do you get past the motion to dismiss when there is a clear conceded illegality? That's what we're talking about. There's no dispute that what is now being fought about is unlawful.
Right.
You because have I think to do it another way. Another way.
And again,
that's all we're talking about, because then you would switch. You both say you would then switch to unjust enrichment if you lose on that.
Well, I think I don't know what you're saying. I said this before, but let me be very clear. I am not aware of a case
right.
okay. in any court where they have enforced an unlawful contract. Okay. So I want to be very clear.
Don't use that verb enforced, that they have held that right. it is a breach. I don't want to get to specific performance. They have ruled that it is nonetheless a breach of the contract for which you get damages when it would have been unlawful to perform, as opposed to saying enforcement of the contract is not lawfully available. Courts can't do that, right? We can't
let me tell you this,
as a breach. I'm going to finish this question, but then you go to unjust enrichment, right? Judge Jackson's question hypothetical would have been, I don't know that anyone would say, I'm going to give you $50 and maybe you'll give me bananas or peaches. It would be, right. I'm giving you $50. You'll give me bananas or peaches, or you'll give me my money back.
Right.
And it seems to me that's why I was asking before, there's sort of two layers
right.
of promises here. And I don't know why everyone has spent their time talking about, is it, you know, education no matter what, or is it education with a limit? Because the question here is, of course, it can't be no matter what, at least as to the narrow question before us of illegality. Unlawfulness. It can't be. That just can't be in any contract.
So all I want to know is the very simple mundane question. Can you survive a motion to dismiss when on the face of the papers, you've essentially pleaded something that is unlawful? That's all I want to know. I don't think you could.
Tell us how you can, or what case says you can.
Because, well, performance in this instance is the contract. Fact. Mm-hmm.
I think we're just asking about the contract claim, right, Judge Edwards?
You are. Yes. And performance in this case of that contract is a factual question. And going to your point, Judge Millett, about snow days, what happens when snow days happen? The classes are made up.
No, we don't want to do snow days.
I'm talking about unlawful now pandemics.
No, I understand. But my point is the university could have said, we are going to honor our contract by making up the classes at such time as it is lawful to do so. They did not do that. Instead, they switched to a totally different mode of instruction.
Wait a minute. You're saying you were damaged here because, like, they didn't wait until fall of 2021 to pick up class. No student wanted that.
Well, that's, again, a factual question, not a pleading question. But if the university's position is that it was infeasible or unlawful for us to perform, there are such times as they would have been able to lawfully perform. And
nobody
knew
when that would be. And it wasn't going to be during this semester.
It was not going to be during this semester, but we would have then a different case that we don't have here. And that is a factual question, which we have not been able to develop. Because again, What we pled was.
But you're not arguing for specific performance that they should all be now let.
No, and we did not plead that.
To progress towards their degrees.
We were very careful not to plead that as well.
So that's not what it's about. It's about whether what is the agreement that when I've paid you, that the law prevents you from performing.
That is a factual question.
It's an unjust enrichment case. And in the unjust enrichment area, they may come back. You'll have a dispute, I suppose, about, you know, they'll have their argument that in fact, we've never promised we weren't unjustly enriched because there was always this caveat. And you'll say, no, there wasn't. But it just seems to me the wrong place to be having this debate is as a breach of contract.
Well, I would just say that as to the breach, it's a factual question because we did not plead in our complaint that they had to complete that in-person on-campus educational experience during the spring 2020 term. And in fact, I think when you look at the factual analysis that you raised of the snow day, what happens? Those classes are made up. And so when you look at the reasonable expectation of the parties, that would be one potential outcome. However, the university offered no choice here. They did not say we were already past the withdrawal deadline. The university could have also said, we'll give you your money back, but you get no credit. They did not give the students that option. They chose for them.
I did not see you pleading that your plaintiffs are going to claim damages that they didn't put off their entire educational career for a year and a half. At that time, it would have been unknown. Who would have known how long it would be? But instead, so what they really wanted is damages because they didn't get to go back and have classes in the fall of 2021.
Those are factual questions.
I thought the dispute was simply that, well, we've paid tuition and there's another layer to this agreement. And that is, sure, if the law prevents you from performing, it prevents you from performing. But if you're going to treat us like online students in which your clients, I assume your clients participated, that from their factual allegations, that's what I understand, they participated. They shouldn't have, if they only got the peaches, but not the bananas, then they get the money back for bananas, right?
That's
correct. You got one line, you didn't get the rest of the deal.
That's correct. But my point is when we're looking at breach in a very narrow focus, it is still a factual question in this case, because there were potentially ways that the university could not have breached the contract even for the mayor's order. And so there were things that the university could have done aside from that. But those are factual questions.
You can say that now, but I'm pretty sure that when they paid that tuition, it was for this semester with these dates.
It is for a specific number of classes.
I know what
classes,
those bills look like.
Right.
It's not we'll provide it to you now or maybe in 3 years.
Right. And I will tell you that some of my clients, when they were given the option, did in fact take the summer and fall semesters off of university because they did not want to go online. That is not what they had bargained and paid for. Here, American gave them an incentive to come back by offering them 10% off of tuition on those terms when they were going to be online.
We're not talking about the summer or subsequent semesters when everybody was on full notice of the circumstances. We're not talking about that. We're talking about what they were supposed to do with the rest of this one semester. That's, as I understand it, what this case is about. You're not suing about anything else.
That's right. The only reason that I raised those points is just to point out that the breach that we are discussing with respect to the illegality is a factual question, because the question is whether or not the contract had to be breached. And so you have to look at the reasonable expectations of the students and the course of conduct during that period of time. There's been no factual development.
And there was a reasonable expectation, you're telling me, that GW or AU would have continued, at least for AU, just for you, but would have continued to provide on-campus education March through May.
Or given them some of the money back, which is exactly what they did weeks later in the summer 2020 term and did again in the fall 2020 term. And so that's the question. It's not,
those are the facts that you would deduce during discovery? Like, I'm trying to understand.
No, of course the students would speak about reasonable expectations and you would look at the documents exchanged between the university, but the tuition payments, the 100% tuition payments were paid for a very specific product and that product was not delivered. And so then the question is the reasonable expectation of the students that product cannot be delivered for whatever reason, that some of that money will be refunded. And the answer is yes. The reasonable expectation, if you do not deliver the bananas and the apples, is that you will refund the appropriate amount of the money under the contract.
Even if you deliver something else, even if there's a substitution, even if
you're— Yes, because, and importantly in this case, we don't have it in every case, but in this case, that is what American did in the summer. They delivered online remote learning. They did it in the fall, and they gave the students a break on the fees, and they gave them a 10% break on the tuition. So yes, that not only was it a reasonable expectation, but it's what actually happened subsequent to that, which is pretty good evidence of—
subsequent conduct is not considered viable evidence of what people intended previously. I mean, we don't normally take into account, right?
I agree, but we're not looking at intent. We're looking at reasonable expectation of the student based upon what the university would do. And I think if you read our complaint, it speaks a lot about the students expected to be treated fairly. I mean, this is just about fairness. It's a prorated refund. They're not looking for a free semester. They're not looking for all of the money back. They're looking for the fair prorated difference between what they prepaid for and what they received in that semester. And in subsequent semesters, that is what American actually, I think, will contend it delivered to them. Of course, we could get into a dispute about should it be 10% or 15% or what have you. But that is evidence that would go to inform the basis of the breach.
An unjust enrichment claim, all this fairness stuff, doesn't it?
Well, unjust enrichment does have a fairness component, but under every contract, there is a good faith, you know, there's a good faith and fair dealing expectation of the parties. And so fairness also goes into a contract analysis.
Are there any other questions from my colleagues?
No.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'll hear from Mr. Schoenfeld. Am I saying that correctly? Or
yes, Your Honor. That's correct. Thanks very much.
Just before you start, so I know we sort of give you 10 minutes for each university, but I think we're just going to, you've got 20 minutes on your clock because we want to be able to ask questions about either university at any given point. So we'll just treat it as a collective period of time for both your clients, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. And I think I'm speaking for both of them, unless I specify, but my arguments are common. I think Judge Jackson's framing of this is exactly right. The first question here is, what was the promise? And is it plausible at the motion to dismiss stage to allege, or for plaintiffs to have alleged, that the university, in fact, made that promise? The promise we heard from plaintiffs' counsel is provide in-person education, period.
No, that's not what both plaintiffs said. The plaintiffs were apart on that.
So I think either one, let me take both iterations of it.
They're very different. And one, the first one said the promise, or what we're alleging the promise was, that as a matter of general practice, we will have on campus and live education. That's different from your formulation.
So if what the promise in either formulation means is that the university made a promise that it breached, when in response to a pandemic, it transitioned to in-person education, the university never did make that promise. The university never would make that promise. And it's implausible to allege that the university made that promise. And the reason we know it's implausible is for a number of reasons. Number one, where the university did express terms in words, it reserved its right to make changes as circumstances demanded. So if the point here is to get into the head of the university and figure out what it meant to promise and what the students expected, what they expected is that the university, generally with respect to any term that might be implied into the contract, reserved its right to make changes as circumstances demanded.
Oh, well, what did they generally promise? I mean, do you disagree with, let me ask you the Beavis question. Imagine an in-person school that runs a deficit after taking the student's tuition, it switches to self-directed learning just to save money. Is that a breach of promise that the students would expect and that the university would understand the students would expect?
So I think it probably—
I've been in this university game too long. I cannot imagine you are arguing that the university would assume the students don't have an expectation, especially where there's a difference between we'll give you online for less and we'll give you on campus for a lot more money. The students don't reasonably expect that as a general matter, we're coming to classes, there will be a teacher there. We understand there'll be this and that, but that's the way we're going to be taught and we're paying for that. So universities don't get that?
No, I think universities get that.
And they also know they can't just shut it down for any reason or no reason and say, you know, we changed our mind. We're going to put it all on Zoom.
Absolutely. And they know that the universe, they retain the discretion to make that decision when they need to do so to protect the health and safety of faculty and students.
That's a different question. I want to make sure I understand that we're together on what I thought was the general understanding between universities and their students, where the university is offering campus in-person education. Everyone assumes it will be a live place with classes, with classrooms, with teachers talking to students, not Zoom. That's clear.
It is, Your Honor, but I want to make sure that where we might differ is clear. As part of that promise, the university retains the discretion to depart from that general practice where it needs to do so in order to protect the health and safety of the students. That's expressly clear in the reservation of the rights, and that's also impliedly clear. I think that's why Mr.
Where is it expressly clear? I mean, you're dealing with, I mean, if you're putting that, are you putting all that in the word necessary?
Well, so I think the reservation of rights confirmed that the universities retain this discretion. The university of
That's the difficulty, because I'm talking about the GW reservation for now. And that says to make, you know, you've got change courses, programs, academic calendar, or to make other changes deemed necessary or desirable.
Correct.
Right? Okay. So there's nothing spilling out here, health and things like that. Now, maybe you're, that's why I asked, maybe you're putting that in the word necessary.
Well, so elsewhere.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So elsewhere, the reservation of rights, I mean, there's three separate reservation of rights provision for GW. It also says modify or change requirements, rules, and fees without notice whenever circumstances warrant such changes. I think there's also a more elemental issue here, which is
back up for just a second, please.
Sure.
You said that was spelled out in the reservation of rights. And what I'm pointing out is that you've got an incredibly sweeping reservation of rights, which would include Judge Edwards' hypothetical, because it says, or desirable.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, no, we would never do that. And you all drafted this.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to understand is, how do we know what the limits are on what you think the agreement was between students and the university on the obligation to provide what I'm calling on-campus education, embracing everything? How do we know that? And how can we possibly say this reservation of rights has the limitations that you seem to want to give to Judge Edwards in an answer, but are not in the text of it?
Well, so with respect to the reservation of rights, there's an implied constraint of good faith, and there's a very well-established body of case law about what constitutes good faith, including in the university context. But implied in any contract where a party has discretion under it, there's an implied limitation for the exercise of good faith. And so if the idea is the university is just doing it to change money, I think that's a plausible case for a breach of the limits of the reservation of rights. But I think, again, we might be getting ahead of ourselves, because I still think Judge Jackson's...
We just want to save money. Instead, the day after tuition is due, so everyone has paid full tuition, put aside installment plans. Let's just say everyone has paid full tuition by X date. And the next day, the university says, pointing to this language or the language in the AU one, our faculty, world-renowned faculty,
right,
have a lot of amazing conferences to attend this spring, amazing research to do that is going to profoundly advance the base of knowledge in their respective areas, their ability to teach in future years, because they're going to learn so much at these conferences, really the educational opportunities that we can provide and the knowledge that our professors can provide to the community and the world will be profoundly enhanced if we go online, so our faculty can go to conferences and take research trips for the rest of the semester. Is that good faith?
No, it's clear to me on the facts as you've alleged that's bad faith. That's
a breach of contract, right? It's a breach of the implied contract, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The timing is the day after the semester begins. These are all facts knowable beforehand. That's absolutely a very clear breach of the constraint of good faith.
They're making mid-semester. Don't make it sound like they're making mid-semester. They couldn't do that.
I don't think they could do that on the facts that you've alleged, and I still think that's bad faith. Those are all facts that...
The or desired language isn't doing much work.
So I think it's still subject to the limitation of good faith, and I think it's important just to go back to an observation. I think you made, Judge Millett. There's no allegation that what motivated the university here was anything other than good faith compliance with, you know, the needs of the students and faculty and also the applicable orders. But again, I don't mean to beat a dead horse on this.
I'm trying to get back to, because we've been going in circles for some time now about is this a dispute about we'll do it no matter what? And you're like, no, we won't do it no matter what under any circumstances. When I don't think that's really the dispute. I think when they want to say is we paid full freight for this semester of on-campus learning. And you knew that we had paid full freight for doing that. You don't need to talk about reservation of rights, honestly, that much other than maybe the word necessary, because it was impermissible. It was unlawful, at least by the time of the lockdown order, for us to have continued providing this on-campus education. And the real crux of this case is, okay, well, we have full on-campus education tuition in hand, and circumstances have arisen where we cannot, and no one disputes, we cannot do it. And so the real contractual dispute, it seems to me, is what happens with that tuition.
Right.
Isn't that the real dispute? No one
says. I don't think so. I think that's a damages question. And before you get to damages, you need to get to breach. And before you get to breach, you need to know what the promise was. So again, just to go back to the kind of elements here, what was the promise? We heard from both sides, it is a promise to provide in-person instruction. And I'm not going to add any sedil at the end as to what, you know, grammatical point or phrase comes after it. A promise to provide in-person instruction. Did the university make that promise? If what that promise means is that the university would provide in-person instruction and it breaches that promise when it transitions to remote instruction mid-semester, the university never made that promise.
Well, what if it made this promise? If this is how I understand their arguments, although again, both of you spent all your time briefing, the brief was all about under any circumstances. And it seems to me instead, the question is, did they understand that if we pay X amount, we'll get on-campus education? If we have only online education, we'll only have to pay X minus Y amount.
No. For a couple of reasons. Number one, it's not an apples to apples comparison. I mean, the American University complaint expressly alleges that there's no undergraduate program offered online at American. So they didn't make a choice.
We don't have a complaint. We don't make
programs.
Allegations, but go ahead.
Plaintiff's complaint includes an explicit allegation that there's no online program for American undergraduates. Mm-hmm. So this wasn't a choice between two different modalities where they selected in-person instruction instead of online. And as to GW, you can't get the degrees that the plaintiffs were attempting to get here online. You can take certain courses and you can get certain degrees and certain postgraduate certificates, but it's not an apples to apples comparison. So for the in-person instruction, for the students who paid for in-person instruction, again, I do think the question is, what were they promised by the university? And I think Judge Cooper said it exactly right. They were promised a presumption of in-person education. Everyone understood it. But the critical question is, did the university impliedly bargain away its discretion to make a change that everyone agrees was necessary in light of the pandemic? And the reason that the
That's
difference
not the
in-
question. There's another question. I don't think they dispute that you had to stop providing on-campus education. The next question is, do you get to keep that exceptional amount of money that was paid for something that we are not getting?
So Judge Millett,
I think you charge less for getting the online stuff. Now, it sounds like there are all kind of factual disputes about the nature of the online program versus the remote learning that happened here. But I understand their argument, at least now, to be to have that to really be about, we agreed to pay on-campus education tuition to get on-campus education. Had we
Judge Millett, I apologize, but
didn't you just say that that's not what the promise was? We agreed to pay that for the presumption that we would get on-campus learning. That's why, whether it's under all circumstances or not, matters. Because the question is, in fact, what they agreed to pay for. Assume away at the beginning that they agreed to pay for getting on-campus learning no matter what, or with period or whatever, then we've already taken care of the issue. But the question is that in fact what the university promised?
I agree with you entirely. Yeah, I agree with you entirely, Judge Jackson, about the framing. But to answer Judge Millett's question first, and I want to make sure I give you a legal answer, not a factual one, since this is a motion to dismiss. Who gets to keep the money is irrelevant unless you find a promise and a breach. And there was no promise here.
I'm asking a different question than Judge Jackson. I'm asking whether when we've paid for something that you can no longer give us, what is your promise? Due to circumstances beyond your control. This isn't your choice. It's not a right that you exercised here. You couldn't have done it.
Understood. But in that circumstance, the promise that was given was a presumption in favor of in-person instruction, which everyone agrees we provided, and then the ability to make a change as circumstances require mid-semester. In those circumstances, there's no breach because the promise is a presumption.
How do we know the promise didn't include, I'll try it from this way, did not include, if we can't do it, if all you're getting, how do we know what the reasonable expectation of both parties was as to what would who would bear the financial consequence of this change?
Because
AU would get to keep all the money. How do we know what their reasonable expectations were, what the agreement was as to that? Isn't that the factual question?
I don't think so. I mean, the question is whether they can plausibly allege a promise that the university would provide in-person instruction and reserve the right to change the method of instruction, operating under good faith, but cede their right to keep the tuition alongside providing remote instruction to everyone. I mean, again, the question is the plausibility of the implied contractual promise that they're alleging here. And it's not plausible to allege that the university would have agreed to a presumption of providing in-person education, reserving its right, as universities have since time immemorial. And I think importantly,
reserving their right to what?
To respond to emergency circumstances. And it's not just the reservation of rights, but I think the DC Court of Appeals decision in Bash recognizes as a matter of DC law that DC universities—
But the thing is, that gets you, all that does is get you to trial, that's all.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Because you're saying, there were circumstances that changed what we were agreeing to. I mean, I'm really having a lot of trouble understanding what you're thinking, students, because I think you agree we have to, there is a contractual relationship between the university and the students. That's a given in this jurisdiction. And if two or three weeks in, can the university say, we don't want to do it this way anymore. The faculty voted. And we don't want to, we're not going to do it. And so we are going to fulfill our obligation by, you can go to Zoom. We don't want to do it this way. And it's not 1 week. It's not right after they got the check.
So I think on that hypothetical, is it plausible to think that the university would say, we will provide in-person education subject to faculty countermand? No, that's not plausible. And no one would make that argument in court. If the promise is we will provide in-person instruction, but we reserve the right, which we will exercise in good faith, which everyone concedes, to make these changes as necessary, that's exactly what everyone expected, because that's the way universities have operated.
That doesn't get you past unjust enrichment, though. You're not suggesting that, right?
Well, I think the unjust enrichment claim fails for precisely that reason, because of the promise here, that is part of the contract, is a promise to provide in-person instruction unless the university makes a determination that it can't to protect health and safety. That's one. So because
that's all about the instruction. It's not about what happens with you pay. They agreed to pay full freight tuition for the full on-campus educational experience. Right. It seems the reservation of rights doesn't talk about retroactive, when changes are made after you've paid. what happens? It seems to me that's maybe the answer is that there wasn't a contractual agreement about what happens with the tuition, and that's what needs to get sorted out in unjust enrichment.
With respect, Your Honor, I disagree. I still think that this question of damages only matters if there's a breach of a contract, and there's no breach of a contract because the term of the contract is that the university will agree to provide in-person education, but reserves the right to make changes as are necessary. And that's exactly why the unjust.
Are you saying reserves the right to keep all of your money for a service they're not going to give you, and that they themselves distinguish from the service they're offering in lieu of the one that they've eliminated? That the you're saying the contract is we reserve to keep you all of your money for the full service, but we're going to take you into a lesser category. And as long as we do that in good faith, you're not entitled to any of your money back. That's what you're saying. That's what the deal was.
I think that is what the deal was, and I think that's what was provided here. The university provided.
I just don't. Where are you finding that? Inability to perform. I understand why you're arguing it as a matter of strategy, because you want to win the money claim. But I just don't see any support for that. Where is this coming from? There's no doubt in everyone's mind what you mean to do. And you've agreed to that starting out. There's no doubt in your mind. And the students understand the same thing. And you're saying, but as long as we can give you a good faith explanation as to why we're going to mid-semester switch you into another mode that you clearly have not bought, clearly, whether it's offered or not, you clearly have not bought. And the university knows that as well. As long as we do that in good faith, and we're going to think of something that's in good faith, you're not entitled to anything back. That was our original deal.
Oh, no. Well, so Your Honor, I want to make two observations. The first one is a factual one. These students in pandemic circumstances, these students received the same instruction by the same professors, same material, got the same course credit towards graduation on time. So I think
we really shouldn't be fighting about qualitatively, and I understand what the law says in that, but if you're even making the suggestion, you're even whispering the suggestion that there's no difference between Zoom offered education and the in-person full campus, that is ridiculous.
I'm not making that
suggestion. And there are very few of us who do this for a livelihood and somewhat full time who would agree. That's an absurd notion. It is not the same qualitatively.
I completely understand, and I'm not advancing that notion because I think it's legally irrelevant here.
Right, I agree.
And so I think this really just goes to what contract promise was made and whether there was a breach. But to go to your example, Judge Edwards, I think I return to the first question Judge Millett asked about the snow day. A breach doesn't become more of a breach because it's a week of snow days versus, you know, 6 weeks of a pandemic. And no one would ever dream to argue that when the university closes for a week and provides remote instruction because students are locked in their houses in a snowstorm, that there's a breach of contract entitling them to damages. And it is nowhere to be found in all of contract law that something that is not a breach with respect to a week becomes a breach in 6 weeks because the circumstances are
wildly different. But my formulation of the promise would be that what the university promised is that as a general matter, pursuant to past practice and custom, we are offering you and asking you to pay for in-person, on-campus learning. And so, of course, a snow day, and everyone understands because that's custom and practice. So there's really not an issue there.
Mr. Schoenfeld, if Judge Edwards is correct that that is the promise, was there a breach on the alleged facts of this case?
Right.
If the promise, and this is where I'm getting a little hung up, because I think that if Judge Edwards is correct, and at least one of plaintiff's counsel has framed it this way, that the promise was, generally speaking, you are going to pay for this in-person experience, and as a general matter, based on custom and practice, we're going to provide it. I think that the facts in this case, the judicially noticed facts that takes us outside of the general course of affairs, the fact that it was infeasible, the fact that it was unlawful, means that when the university didn't provide the service pursuant to that promise, they actually did not breach because they only promised to do it as a general matter in the course of affairs that ordinarily exists. Am I wrong about that, Mr. Schoenfeld?
I think on that iteration of the promise, you're exactly right. I mean, again, I think the question of damages is a challenging one, and I don't want to be ungenerous here. And my kids went to school and I paid tuition and they were stuck in my den in front of Zoom for several months. And so I get all of this. But, you know, the question in a breach of contract case is what the promise was and whether it was breached. And there is no universe in which the plaintiffs can plausibly allege that the university made a promise. And here it's only an implied promise, because I think we all agree there's nothing express, made an implied promise that they were going to provide in-person instruction, no matter the fact that, you know, the 11th plague had arrived, and that students would be entitled to a refund in those circumstances. I don't see where, impliedly or expressly, you get that last tail end about the return of the funds. I don't see where you get
that we would keep it all. I mean, that's the problem. Maybe this implied contract just didn't address what happens with the payment. I see the reservation rights, the right to change thing, but I don't see you saying anywhere, and you can point me to it, that says, or what your evidence of an implicit agreement is, we're going to keep it. And it's not fair to, you know, snow days at the time these contracts were entered into, education via Zoom was like on a mass scale like this hadn't happened.
We're all, yeah, used, exactly.
Yeah, it hadn't happened.
Right. And so I think that
the expectation with snow days was my education will get made up. It'll get made up on campus. Okay. And so the question here is, when you just have this legally mandated, and schools to be applauded for the resourcefulness with which they responded, but you have this change where we cannot provide what you paid for. And we have the ability to adapt like that. We have to.
You are also, if I heard
what do I do? What happens with the money? Yeah, where's that agreement?
And along with that, I want to make sure I'm understanding your argument. I remember DC case law that says the fact that you have breach of contract and unjust enrichment on the table at the same time, that's doesn't preclude the unjust enrichment. I'm looking at Bibas's opinion now. He clearly assumed, you can tell me if you think he's wrong, he's clearly assumed, citing the restatement, that if the contract performance under the contract is not possible because of changed circumstances, the claim of unjust enrichment can still be pursued. Are you saying it cannot be?
So I think when the contract speaks to the issue and the party's rights are dictated by the contract, you don't get to bring an unjust enrichment claim. And I think DC case law is completely clear on that. So DC case law allows you to bring an unjust enrichment claim in cases where the contract is invalid or unenforceable, which we don't have here, or where the contract doesn't speak to the relationship at issue. And I think plaintiff's cases, Cafasian and APA fee litigation, speak to precisely those circumstances. But here, we've got a contract. It just doesn't say what the plaintiffs want it to say. The implied term here is that the universities will make best efforts to provide an in-person education, and they reserve the right to make those changes. I mean, the idea that the university would bargain away its discretion to make these sorts of changes under these circumstances is completely implausible. And I think that's
the question. The question before you is not whether you could adapt, whether you could stop providing an on-campus education. You didn't have a choice, or whether you could adapt. I get your argument about that. What I don't see is a separate one about, but who bears the financial consequence of this? We have collected for something that we know we're not delivering. We're doing the best we can under the circumstances, but it's not what any of us thought you were going to get for this money. None of you thought when they paid in January or February, whenever it was, that this is what you'd be getting for this money. There was never an agreement about that or even an expectation about that.
So, Your Honor, let me answer the question in two ways. I think the first one is, again, and I don't mean to be thick about this, but I don't think you get to the question of damages unless there's a breach. And you don't get to a breach unless there was a promise. And here the promise, I don't think I can say it any better than Judge Cooper, but the only plausible promise was a presumption of in-person instruction and a delegation to the university of some discretion to make changes that are reasonable in light of the circumstances. In those circumstances, I think the clear implication is that there is no breach, when the university exercises its discretion that way. And because there's no breach, there's no entitlement to damages. The second point I would make is if we are in a universe where we're trying to figure out the difference in value between what the students provide were supposedly promised and what they were provided, I do think we run headlong into this academic deference doctrine. Yeah,
I don't No. There's no doubt. I don't know that you would lose on restitution. Because I mean, and I don't want you to think my questions are suggesting that. I don't know how that comes out. That's a heck of a fight, because I know the other side of this is I know how much time, money, and effort the universities and colleges were putting into making the switch. I don't know how that plays out. That's a different question entirely.
I understand. And that's why I addressed it strictly to this question of damages. But again, and I don't mean to repeat myself, but I do see this as a very early in the pleadings question of the plausibility of plaintiff's allegation that the universities promised that they would provide in-person instruction and that they breached that promise when they transitioned to remote instruction. I think Judge Jackson has sort of had the framing correct in that way, that again, 12b6 motion, plausibility of the allegations, is it plausible? And I think Judge Cooper had it exactly right. And I would just quote his line.
What's not plausible? I mean, we've read Judge Cooper's decision. What's implausible about their contention that tuition will be treated like housing and meal plans? And that is that when you can't do it, and we're not faulting you for not doing it, will be some prorated refund. Because I'm discerning that from this contract. The fact that you would do your best doesn't mean, you know, you were going to do your best to house people. You were going to do your best to feed people. But you recognized as to those that we need to prorate this. And so how do we know that there wasn't a similar understanding between the students and the university, a reasonable expectation, at least on the part of the students, that that's what would happen with tuition?
Well, I think there's two things. Number one, let's say mid-semester, the classics department ups and leaves and moves from GW to Georgetown or GW to some other school. There's no refund, even if the students aren't able to complete their semester as classics majors. That's never happened. The university always retains discretion to make substitutes, to put people into different programs, to have English teachers teaching classics departments. That's never been part of the expectation at universities. Always universities are deemed to be able to exercise.
Wait a minute. It's one thing to say we're going to substitute teachers in. Tell me if there's a case that says if you said mid-semester, sorry, classics students, we can't educate you anymore. We lost everybody.
Yeah, I mean,
educate you. What would happen then?
Shaking your head. I'm wondering where you're getting that notion from. Yeah.
Well, so I apologize, Judge Jackson.
Sorry, no. What I'm asking, I guess I'm trying to figure out the hypothetical and its application to the current scenario. Isn't it more like we're not going to educate you with the particular professors that were on the scene at
Right? So I'm sorry, Judge Jackson. Can we go back to my question? Because I was responding to something you said. Yeah. And so I get, that's why I said, if we substitute other teachers to teach the classics or something, that may be different. I just want to answer to this question. If you say to them, we can't provide it, you're saying that it's always been understood, oh, well?
So, I mean, faculty leave every semester, department shut down.
Okay, department completely shut down, and all your other teachers are already teaching. There's nobody to come in and start teaching all these other classes now. What would happen there? What's your view under the reservation of rights? You get to keep their tuition?
I think so, yeah. I mean, if you're able to provide an education generally, just not in their major, they have 3.5 other years to complete their major with a reconstituted department.
Please don't change my hypothetical. My hypothetical is, and I'll make it even more detailed for you. Seniors, we've got to finish this semester to have our credits, we have to get credits in classics. It's not general credits at this point. We can't graduate with a classics degree without it. But the classics department has up and left mid-semester. We've already paid, but we can't. And the university doesn't have faculty available or equipped to come in and pick up teaching these high level courses on classics for the rest of the semester. But of course you have to make a change because they left. What's your position?
I think if the university is unable to provide the credits and the progress towards graduation that mm-hmm. they promised, that is a breach. In those circumstances,
it, okay. So that's not within the reservation of rights. Good. That's well, I so just want to make sure I understood what you were saying.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the specific bargain for exchange that's at the heart of these agreements is a number of credit hours for particular tuition dollars, and everyone concedes that those were provided here. So the question of how the university changes instructors, modalities of instruction, you know, course offerings, that's what's left to the discretion of the university. And I refer the court to the First Circuit's opinion.
Wait, you're saying it's to the complete discretion of the university? I thought there was an agreement up front that, no. So can you will provide on-campus education if at least, you know, at least the agreement is to the extent possible. So that's not just totally in your discretion. That's your promise to them with the, you know, to the extent, at a minimum for this case, at least to the extent lawful.
Mr.
Yeah, Trump, absolutely.
Can I offer another hypothetical that might be illuminating in terms of this particular point? So the university has glossy magazines and materials that show their wonderful new chemistry lab building that they've created. It's $1 million. It's got all of these wonderful features. And midway through the semester, students who came to that university paid their tuition up front, said we want to be chemistry majors because we were so enticed by your facility. Midway through the semester, the facility burns to the ground. And the university has to get restarted, start up the old building, the building that was before related to chemistry. And no, it was not the expectation that students would be getting their chemistry instruction in that other place. But there we are. My question is, in that circumstance, do we have a breach? Do we have a situation in which the students who came to the school expecting that they'd be in the shiny new building get their money back if they're still getting chemistry from the professor the way that the university promised for credits toward their chemistry degree? Do they get the money back in that situation? Is there some sort of breach?
There's no breach and they don't get their money back. I mean,
the buildings burned down.
So
every building on campus burns down.
Right. And so
the shiny building, there's no question. The students are not going to win that in a heartbeat. But all the buildings are burned down.
The university pivots. And they pivot to Zoom.
One at a time. Sorry, let's just do this one at a time. Let's get an answer to Judge Edwards' question, please.
If the university burns down, and let's say GW moves to Reston, some gross apartment building, you know, where
haven't been able to figure out where they're going to move. So the next semester, the next school year, they have no particular plans. Give us our money back.
For the current semester, which I think is what completes the analogy, if they provide instruction allowing people to get credits over Zoom, there's no breach and they don't get their money back. If they move to a different physical space, even if it's inconvenient for students, but teachers are, you know, teaching in broom closets, but provide the instruction and, you know, give them credits towards the orderly progress towards their degrees, I don't think there's a breach.
Well,
and I don't think
this?
They get their money back.
What about this? I'm not talking about the next semesters and stuff. We have time to plan to finish out this half a semester. We don't have another building to move you to. So we're going to move online, chemistry majors. And you all have had to go home. But what the teachers, instead of you doing hands-on experiments and learning, the professor will show you videos of other people having done these experiments in the past. And you just have to sit and watch the videos and we'll give you the credits to get your degree.
So that's not what happened here, but I'm going to answer your question. So I think in those circumstances, there's no breach of contract and the students don't get their money back. If the university-
Why don't you give them degrees? Why don't you give them credits toward the degrees? So really what GW and AU could have done here is in middle of March, it said, we're not going to provide you anything. We'll just go ahead and credit you for each class for the semester, pass, fail. See you next fall.
In good faith. No, I don't think that would have been in good faith. The university to stand behind graduate or undergraduate degrees that someone didn't earn?
They got they're getting their credits. You did half the semester, you'd say. You did half the semester. So we're going to give you the credits. You did 51% of the semester. We'll round up. You get your credits and you get to progress towards your degree.
I don't think that would be good. I don't think the university would do that. And I don't think it would be good faith. I think for the university to give students degrees that they didn't earn or course credits that they didn't earn, I think there's a fair implication of bad faith in that hypothetical.
I'm sorry, Judge Jackson, did you have more?
I don't know. I was just going to say, but not in the hypothetical in which the university makes a pivot, right, in good faith to provide the instruction, albeit in a different format, and the albeit in a different format is taken care of by the university's express reservation of rights to make changes to its programs. That's what I understand your argument to be, and that therefore there is no breach in that situation.
I think that's exactly right. And the last thing I'll say is I think the reservation of rights is entirely consistent with the way case law, including DC case law, has regarded this type of university decision-making. Bash makes entirely clear that as a matter of law, DC universities retain precisely this type of discretion. And it's not reasonable as a matter of law for students to have a contrary expectation or believe that universities are not going to make precisely this type of decision. And that's consistent across the jurisdictions. I would refer the court to the First Circuit's decision in Quesnoy that makes this point exactly. But as a matter of DC law, it's entirely clear from Bash.
Before we switch to the other counsel, I just want to let you know, it is not entirely clear to me what DC law says about the availability of unjust enrichment in a situation where there is a contract being disputed. The case law is not as conclusive as you're suggesting, that if the contract doesn't cover it, that's the end of it, no unjust enrichment. That is not what I'm seeing, but I'm a little bit confused as I just went back and looked at these again. And I want the other side to know as well, because you've been firm in saying unjust enrichment cannot possibly be in play here. And that's not what I'm seeing in DC case law.
Sure. So I think that is DC law, but just to answer your question or to explain that there are other bases on which to dismiss or affirm dismissal of the unjust enrichment claim, there's also nothing unjust here because there was no promise made. For all of the reasons
that we're going round and round on that. I'm really at the very limited question as to whether or not where you have a contractual matter that end the discussion on unjust enrichment. I'm not reading the DC cases to say that.
Understood, Your Honor. And I'll just finish on this point. My understanding is Falcone Sachs makes clear that, you know, the idea that if you have a contract, then there's no unjust enrichment claim, that overstates things. But I do think DC law is clear that unjust enrichment only comes into the picture when the underlying contract is unenforceable for some reason, or where it doesn't cover the dispute between the parties. Where there's a term express or implied in the contract, you can't have an unjust enrichment claim. And I think given DC law about the very specific circumstances under which a claim, contract claim between a university and a student arises, there's a particular peril in reading unjust enrichment doctrine too broadly to supplement agreements. So.
Thank you, agree if the contract, I think I heard you say if the contract is unenforceable,
yeah,
then unjust enrichment does apply. You did just say
You did say
that. So I think that's what the case says. I think if a contract fails for lack of consideration, for example, then there's the potential of unjust enrichment, which is why, you know, to go to your framing of the case, Judge Millett, about the illegality. That's why I think it's important to consider it in the frame that Judge Jackson has adopted, which is it plausible that there was a promise in the first place? I think when unjust enrichment law talks about a contract that's unenforceable, what it's getting at is a contract. Unjust enrichment is a substitute for a failed contract. That's not what we have here. I think that's the easiest way to put it.
All right. Do my colleagues have any more questions for Mr. Shanahan?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Given everyone up a very long time, but it's because it's helpful to discuss this with you all. We do appreciate the time everyone is committing. So I understand both of our appellants want to do rebuttal. It's been a long morning, so I'm going to give you each 2 minutes, please. And if it's okay with Judge Edwards, I will ask you to start by responding to his question about what happens. Is unjust enrichment available here? If for example, illegality. superseding illegality, not of the initial contract.
You want me to take that one, Dan?
You're welcome to. Go for
okay. Okay. So, Judge Edwards, I would just point you, and it's on page 28 of our initial brief, the Harrington v. Trotman case, and here's what that case says. Obviously, it deals with the unenforceable. So if there was a breach on behalf of the party bringing the claim, impracticability of performance, frustration of purpose under the statute of frauds, or in consequence of the other party's avoidance for some reason as misrepresentation, duress, mistake, or incapacity, a court can grant equitable relief. And so if you, and that's straight from the resecond, from the restatement of contracts. I mean, this is black letter contract law. That is when you have it. But in fact, DC goes further. And if you look further down in that case, DC law allows an equitable claim, unjust enrichment, to supplement a breach of contract claim where the damages under the breach of contract claim may be insufficient. And those cases that are cited are Lee v. Foot with an E, 481 A2D 484, Ingeber, I-N-G-B-E-R v. Ross, which is 479 A2D 1256, and International Tours, which is 491 A2D 1149. Those cases actually allow an equitable claim when there is a viable breach of contract claim, but the damages aren't sufficient under that breach of contract claim. And in fact, Falcone, which we cited this on page 30 of our initial brief, says specifically, the statement that there can be no unjust enrichment in contract cases is plainly erroneous. DC law not only allows for unjust enrichment in a situation where the contract is impracticable, impossible, or avoidable, but it allows for the equitable claim in a contract claim. What you can't do under DC law is recover double damages. You can't recover the same damages on the contract claim that you recover on the unjust enrichment claim. And so in a situation where there was an enforceable breach of contract claim, you can't also double down and have unjust enrichment damages, which are duplicative, but you can have unjust enrichment damages, which supplement if you did not get full relief on your breach of contract claim. And that's black letter law.
I appreciate that. I think we all agreed that written into every contract is a limitation on performance that is unlawful. And if that's the case, does that mean that as of March, whenever the two schools on different dates said we have to go, we can no longer provide on-campus education because of the pandemic, does that mean that there was never a contract, a contractual obligation to provide there was no contract to provide on-campus education at that point. And so there's nothing unjust about them retaining the money, that there was always an asterisk next to the tuition bill, or in all of it, as part of this implicit agreement that we can't do what's unlawful. That itself is a limitation on the scope of the contract. So no breach of contract and no unjust enrichment, because it's not unjust, because we never promised to provide it in circumstances like this. We did the best we could.
Well, unjust enrichment simply looks at the inequity between the parties. And in this case, as Your Honor noted earlier in the argument, the students paid full rate, full fare for something. And so that is what unjust enrichment would look at. It's not the intention of the university.
What did they pay full fare for?
They paid
full fare for on-campus education at a minimum, at least here, to the extent permissible by law. And they got that.
That's an additional provision which might void the contract. It doesn't say in the contract to the extent permissible by law.
It's not voiding the contract. It simply says that there's a limit on what anybody can agree to.
And Mr. Lilly, the whole problem is that we don't have express language in the contract. The question is, what did the contract actually say? So it's
exactly
not an answer to say that term is not in the contract, right? We don't know what's in the contract. What is plausible to have included.
And briefly, if I may, just on that point, because Mr. Schoenfeld indicated in his argument that there was nothing in our complaint related to online learning prior to this, and there is. If the court looks at paragraphs 21 through 32 of our complaint, we specifically plead, and American said at the time on its website, quote, we do not offer undergraduate online degrees, in all bold. That has since been removed. But at the relevant time period, that was on the website. And there are other things pled there with respect.
But of course, the shift here was not to an online degree, right? I mean, the shift here was a temporary period of online instruction is not the same thing as an online degree.
That's not Mr. Schoenfeld's argument. Mr. Schoenfeld's argument is if they deliver the degree in exchange for the tuition, then the deal is done.
Right.
And our point is the facts.
In the hypothetical, right? In the hypothetical, maybe. Yeah.
No, he specifically said, and he argued at the district court level, that the provision of the credits and the degree in exchange for the money is the deal. There is no deal for in-person, on-campus education between the parties. And what we have pled in the complaint and what I'm attempting to show you now is not only did we plead those facts, but American even went so far as to say, we don't offer this type of degree. So there was not only an expectancy on behalf of the students, which is all that we have to prove, but an intention on behalf of the university to say that, no, we only offer in-person on-campus.
Can you answer Judge Millett's question, which is, even if there was that intention, even if there was that term, isn't it subject to an implicit condition that whatever they're offering, it has to be consistent with the law? So in other words, implicitly, fine, they agreed. There was a contract for in-person degrees. But doesn't that have to carry with it the understanding that whatever it is we're giving you has to be consistent with the law?
And if we can't give it to you, you get the money back. That's the part that's
necessary.
Missing.
Why do you say that that's necessarily implied in this agreement? That's where I'm getting hung up.
Because that is the very basis of a service contract. I will pay you for X service. If for whatever reason you cannot deliver X service, I get money back. Here we're not asking for all the money back.
But doesn't that assume that you're defining the X service to me?
They defined it.
No. What I'm saying is that if you're saying that it necessarily means I get my money back, then the service that was promised was you have to have it or else, right? If it is implicit that you will always get your money back for the service, then what is promised at the beginning is a money back guarantee. Am I right about that? I mean, that's what it is.
Yes, that is what a contract is, unless it's disclaimed otherwise.
So you're saying that implicit in every contract is a money back guarantee. That unless you say otherwise, when you are making a promise in the context of a contract, you are guaranteeing that the person will get what is being discussed or they'll get their money back. There's never a world for you in which you could have a situation like the ones we discussed.
No, unless it is disclaimed.
And didn't they disclaim it in the context of the reservation of rights? Didn't they say?
No.
No, they didn't. Okay.
No, and we dedicated a lot of briefing to this, and that the reservation is so vague, it would not even under Williston on contracts, it is plainly unenforceable. I mean, they essentially say in that disclaimer that we can cancel this whenever we want, and that is not enforceable as a matter of contractual provisions. As I noted earlier, there are other schools that said, if there is a pandemic, if there is a public health emergency, we will not perform under our in-person on-campus promise. That would be, they could do that, and the parties would have contracted for that, but they didn't.
They'd have to say it at that level of detail. They couldn't say if it's necessary for us to change our programs. You're saying
yes.
That's
and back to my day of the week example, you can't say we are free to not perform under the contract on any day of the week we choose. If you aren't going to perform on Sundays because that's your holy day, then you're required to say in the contract, we will not perform on Sundays. If it simply says we will not perform on any day of the week of our choosing, we don't have a contract at all. We have an illusory agreement.
Okay. Thank you. My colleagues have more questions for Mr. Willie. Is it Willie?
Yes, that's quite all right.
All right.
Thank you. I've enjoyed appearing.
Mr. Krosky, you started and now we'll let you finish your 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I don't have too much to say above and beyond what Mr. Willey said, which, you know, by and large, we agree with and co-counsel with Mr. Willey in multiple cases where we've passed the motion to dismiss stage on very similar allegations that we've presented here. But I think ultimately, you know, Rule 8 can be met even if it strikes a savvy judge that actual proof of the facts is unlikely. And we ultimately pled all of the elements necessary to assert breach of contract claims. Issues associated with illegality, we maintain the position that that's issues of affirmative defense that ultimately involve fact issues that are appropriate for resolution on another day, not on whether we've stated a basic claim for a breach of contract. We know we can because we have in other cases as well on the same facts. And so we'd respectfully request that the court reverse the district court's with prejudice dismissal of our contract and unjust enrichment claims and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you. And thanks. Do my colleagues have more questions?
No.
Okay. Thanks to everybody for your thoughtful presentations and for the amount of time you devoted to this morning. It's been helpful and the case is submitted.